Well, good morning, everyone.
Really?
It's good to be here this morning. We are working on my slides. But we'll do a review of last week's dessert. And can you turn it down just a smidgen, please? It doesn't do well with voices in my head. My echo. Last week was an interesting conversation. I went home and was thinking about it and got a previous conversation I had before I left church regarding a movie. I watched it. It's called Life by Jack. And
The Life of Chuck.
Chuck! The Life of Chuck. Stuck in my head. It's got some potty language in it, but if you get past some of the language, it's an amazing story about an individual's journey through life, but it starts at the end and ends at the beginning. And I recommend it. I really do. It makes you think a lot about just life itself, the notion of suffering, and obviously, at the beginning, I don't give it all away, is the impact that individuals have in the world, in the midst of the good and the bad. And lives are changed, and we don't know about that. We just don't understand, I don't think, the impact we have in the lives around us by the way we live. And it might just be something very small that you do. Saying hello to the cashier at Safeway or Albert's, calling them by name, that type of thing. So anyway, I recommend this movie. It's good. So suffering in the Bible is central in a very complex subject. It's a theme that spans both the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it is explored in various ways. It's explored sometimes as punishment, sometimes as a test, and at other times a path to deeper faith or even redemption in individual lives. So I just want to put a bookmark right there and say, did you think about anything this week after we left last week more confused than when we started? I was. Any reflections from last week?
I wish I hadn't said what I said.
I don't know if you remember what was said, but I think that was beautiful. I think that comes from a place of just, I don't get it. I don't understand. What is God's role in history? What is God's place in my life? How do I interact with maybe a God who's not involved? Like I think he's involved, or they're involved. And so, yeah, Mark, don't go back. Because I think what you said, I think is a lot of how a lot of us feel, is like there really is no answer. The destination is the journey, right? You've heard that one before. I used to have a shirt. I don't like it anymore. Because I want the answer. That's how I live. So we looked at consequences of sin. Free will. In Romans 1:24, God gave them over to their sinful desires. And so God says, okay, if you're going to choose to separate yourself from me, I'm going to let it go. Not that God's going to fix things in their lives, but he allows us to make choices. And sometimes those choices do impact others around us, and it does impact us physically, mentally, and emotionally. And so it's a consequence of separation. This week, I shared an article and received an article from Dr. Lewis Robinson, and which we'll get to in a few minutes, but I have landed on a few of my own ideas about suffering. And this is free. It's not included in the course. So just here's where I landed this week. Suffering is an individual experience. Duh. Right? I mean, at its stripped down level, it is individual. It impacts those around us. Suffering is somewhat of a vortex that spins and pulls people in, whether they want to go or not. It impacts people around us. So it's individual. Since it is individual, there is an overriding bias that we bring into our own suffering. A bias that can also be placed on others that are suffering. And those biases, since suffering is individual, life experience, cultural influences, family systems, work experience, and how one sees themselves in their world impacts how suffering is viewed. Let me say that again. There's a lot there. The bias is life experience, cultural influences, family systems. I was raised by, there's got to be a reason behind what's going on in your life, isn't it? My mom would always say, well, who are you hanging out with? I was sick, you know. I mean, it was from them. So my life experience through my family system is there has to be a reason assigned to what's taking place in your life right then. As I grew up, that's not very helpful. Work experience. You bring everything with you, what's going on in your life, through work, and really how you see yourself walking in the world. I walk through the world like everybody wants to talk to me. Everybody's my friend. Hey, it's good to see me, isn't it? Right? I mean, that's how I think. That's how I see the world. Now, others walk in and are afraid of people seeing them. Or they're self-conscious about the way they're walking into a room. That is so foreign to me. My wife just says, you know, just stop. We get it. So, another bias is one's spiritual journey and individual relationship with God. Your spiritual journey, the things that shaped you spiritually throughout your life. And I was raised in a black and white world, so it's got to be this or this. It's a dualistic way of living. It's either up or it's down, it's right, it's left. And so my spiritual journey was that. So there's got to be reasons. And so you can't attach a reason when there isn't one, but you work hard at it. It's like a poor dog chasing his tail. The last one I landed on was interpretation of the purpose of suffering and God's overall participation in history. With all my biases, I bring a lens, if you would, an interpretation of how I view my suffering. And you do too. So with all that being said, the final thing of all my list here is a one size does not fit all approach to suffering, because each person is bringing a different story, a different way that they've been raised. I did a genogram with my family system when I was in grad school, and basically it's just a history of thinking and, you know, this abuse and that abuse and this, all this stuff going through history of your family, you know. And I traced a lot of Don't do this because God's going to get you. You fall, you marry a good Christian woman, and you'll have good Christian kids who all go to church. Did you hear that one growing up? God will take care of you. It's almost like a health and wealth type of approach to living. So we bring some of that with us now, and so you draw a line and say, that doesn't work anymore, so now what do I do? And we live in an ever-changing world, don't we? New sufferings, we're faced every day with a new suffering. We just have to turn on the TV or get on Facebook or social media. We'll see a new version of suffering. So it's nothing new. Stop. Any thoughts, comments? insults. Microphone.
When I was 20 and had Jared, he was born with a club foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I knew nothing of what that was or what it was going to entail, so I know that my child had a deformity. And I was in a four-bedroom, and the other three young ladies, were not married. And I thought, I did this right. I got married. I had a child. Why is my child having a deformity in their church? And I would hide him. I would hide it. Because I wasn't ashamed of him, but I didn't want anyone to look at him differently.
Right.
But I really did have that crisis of, I did these right, so this shouldn't have happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah, good thing you're sharing that. And you want to protect your child.
Yes.
Right? You want to protect that suffering or what lies ahead of them. So I said, I'm taking your job out of here.
This may play into it a little differently, but I think it plays in just by the fact that you've mentioned looking through different lenses. I feel like it comes down a lot to personality.
Mm-hmm.
How deeply you take things in. How, you know, some people have the ability to kind of ride the wave of suffering easier than other people who, you know, feel like they don't deserve it. And Alpha, I totally relate. I felt that way about not being able to have children.
Mm-hmm.
How we did everything right, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes from our background. How, you know, there are answers for everything.
Right.
So living in the mystery is huge. Just not having all the answers is huge. But I also think personality plays a
Yeah, that's a really good point, that personality and character.
Hijacking it. We were in Southern California last Sunday and went to church with our friends, and the Bible study was on First Peter, and the verse was, be ready to give an answer. And the conversation bordered on, as Christians, we're obligated to explain everything to everybody. And it's sort of one of those things where the church doesn't help when it teaches that kind of teaching.
Yeah. I had one of those answer things, like, little in the back of my Bible. If someone asks you this, and I go here, right?
I think not only is it deeply personal and all of the things that you say play into it, then you have the collective and everybody else's personal, how they then treat you, right? So if somebody could be in a space where maybe they moved beyond that theology and they started to come to terms and understand it's not anything that I did, it's not, and then your faith community and other people are right there and then they treat you because they're still in that space and that, again, goes by how deeply you take things. You know, Michael and I are very different, and it's very easy for him sometimes, with certain people, to, that's their stuff, don't take that, like, that, none of that you should take personally. I take everything very personally, right? And it just gets deeper. And so it's like, I might be in a different space, but then I'm confronted with somebody who's back in that old theology.
Right.
And how that then just adds to the increased suffering.
Right. And I think that plays in nicely. I think that plays in nicely to the idea about personal bias and the idea of individual suffering. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding because of my own bias. If let's say Lewis is suffering, you know, my biases don't fit his. And so I have this place of, like this, I'm not really connecting because I don't understand fully what he's bringing to the moment. And so then what do you do with that? I think the answer for me is you just be. Just be. Pete and then Kevin.
So, I mean, I think it's a good point.
I just don't know the full extent of how our different personalities impact this. I do think it's a mistake to feel like someone who looks like they're riding the wave, that somehow that is a stronger response.
Yeah.
Because what you see is may not be what's under the surface.
Yes.
They just don't express it in the same way. Or the judgment that they don't feel it is.
Yeah.
So, just a caution.
Yeah, that's a good point because, you know, right away the person may look like they're fine, but there might be a war going on between the ears. So, Kevin.
One thing you start out, you know, recouping the scriptural things, and you know, I'm thinking about the wisdom literature and how there's, you know, the righteous will prosper in Proverbs a lot, and then you go to the Ecclesiastes, it says all is vanity, you know, and so there's all these sides that are a biblical perspective, which is maybe man's perspective on how God works, and it's one point of view, and then we talk about how the church can offer bad advice. Well, that's the play, the book of Job, you know, where here we have these characters that are godly characters, maybe giving this bad advice to Job, and we see the range of interpretation on stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's a good fit with the idea of bias. I just really believe there can't be a one-size-fits-all, even to the interpretation of Scripture. And I think we spend all our lives trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong. My mom still asks me the same question every week. She just can't get her mind around that there's just not really an answer, Mom. You know, and even the interpretations we have in the Bible are from the perspective of the writers. Right? Even though we claim it's God-inspired, which I believe God inspired them to write, but it's their perspective. I'll stop there. So today we're going to take a look at what other religions and mystics have to say about suffering. And then I really want to spend the last part of time that we have together with exploring God and the presence of people in the world. And see if we can not deconstruct, but try to separate evil from God, God from evil. So, real quick, we're going to look at the right button. Do I have it on? Oh, you know, that's a small font, isn't it? You look big on my screen. But just real quick, you know, the Catholics really do have different themes and approaches of how they interpret suffering and reasons. They attach some really good reasons to suffering. And they see suffering as redemptive. They believe that suffering can unite us with Christ, passion, and then for the benefit of others. The whole notion of, you know, praying and taking on someone else's sins after they have died while they're in purgatory, so our redemptive work and our understanding in the prayer life can fix that person as they're experiencing purgatory. Sacramental worldview, suffering is often approached through sacraments like anointing of the sick, which offers grace and healing. Just talked about post-death suffering. It's a purification. It's seen as part of sanctification and preparing the souls for heaven. And the whole notion of saints and martyrs, when we were on the Camino, we met Father, what's his name? Remember his name? Come on, Dan. But anyway, they were trying to get this individual to be considered for sanctum, to be a saint. And they had a piece of his cloth from his robe that was known if you touch this cloth, your prayers will be answered or you'll be healed. This week, have you noticed Carlos Acetis from Italy is now the youngest saint ever, a 15-year-old boy that was died of leukemia. They now have his body entombed somewhere. I think it's in Assisi in Italy. And people are making pilgrimages. And now his sainthood is connected with the use of internet and website. People go to his website and put their prayers on their website, and lo and behold, things happen. So the Catholicism really ties into a lot of the martyrdom and the saints just for the purpose of redemption. So suffering is meaningful when offered in union with Christ. It can purify, it can sanctify, and even assist in the salvation of others through intercessory suffering. Next slide, please. There we go. So, Protestantism. It's a broad range of traditions, such as Lutheran, Reformed, the Evangelical. But here are some common threads. Basically, faith alone. Suffering does not earn salvation, but faith in God's grace does. Thus, suffering is not notorious in itself. So the actual act or the experience of suffering is absolutely nothing. The point is, your faith in God is the fix in this situation. God's sovereignty, especially in the Reformed churches, the Calvinist theology, suffering, part of God's providential plan. Oh boy. Even when we don't understand it. I highlighted a phrase that I used really irresponsibly early on. It's God's will. That's a big fix, isn't it? I think that is just a lousy way out of a situation that you have no idea. But you got to say something, so it's God's will. Not helpful. For me. The cross is central for the evangelicals. They stress the cross as the ultimate answer to human suffering. It's Christ-centered. Christ suffers instead of us, so it's penal substitution. So, he suffered on our behalf. The cross is central. Character formation. Suffering is often seen as God's way of maturing believers. A stripping away. The refiner's fire. You've heard that, right? The refiner's fire. This is it's going to hurt. Believe me, it's going to get better. But you got to go through this. I struggle with that. Next slide, please. So the mystics spent a lot of their lives trying to understand the role of suffering in the world. And in fact, some of their own sufferings. I will go through all these. So it's like suffering as union with Christ. Suffering tests and strengthens love for God. In your deepest, darkest times, do you feel a deeper connection to God in the moment, or is it in retrospect? That's rhetorical. I'm looking for God in the midst of that. Okay, where are you? Why is this happening? And what am I learning from this? I never get any answers for that, other than just, I'm with you. That's it. I'm with you. Next slide, please. Suffering is compassion and solidarity. Mystics viewed their own suffering as a way of entering more deeply into the pain of others. I find that really interesting. Suffering softens the heart, and it gives way to mercy. You come out on the other side of suffering in a different way. You're different when you come out of an extended period of time of suffering. Your biases may have been impacted. The things that you carried into suffering are things you don't walk out with at times. So you're shaped, the people around you are shaped differently. You know, I just, honestly, 4 years ago when they said, Billy, you got 2 years to live, I didn't know what to do with that, other than I got to get things in order here. Right? And so I just kind of lived into this place of, okay, I guess this is what it means to be dying. I'd never faced that before. But it was forced upon me. Through evil in the world. We'll get there. Suffering as purification. Suffering as union with Christ. This is the mystics. This has gone on since like the 14th, 13th century. That the mystics, the spiritual people, wrestled with the idea of suffering in the world and their own suffering. Some mystics saw suffering as not a contradiction to God's love, but as a mysterious disclosure of God's love. I'll stop right there. Comments? Questions? Just more questions, huh? Kevin?
So I'm wondering, as you recount this, I'm thinking back to the beginning of the discussion where you said it was individual, and these people are brought up in or have become part of the faith community, right? And so that's that lens through which they see their suffering. But, you know, you can see all kinds of examples where people, they hate God because of their suffering. Right?
Yeah.
So again, it's that individual lens. And I'm thinking, like, what was her name? Joni, the gal that didn't have any arms and would draw and paint.
Oh,
and
yeah. Joni Erickson.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were talking about a mystic. Go ahead.
Yeah,
she is.
Same kind of thing. It just brought her, she saw her disabilities as a way to become closer to Christ.
Yeah. And I wonder if she started there.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't always start there. I think this class is really out of what I went through. So I can speak into this. At the time, I wasn't thinking, yeah, there's a class coming out of this. I can't wait. Can't wait to write this stuff down. Okay, go.
Something that Gina said as we were sitting and listening is that suffering can soften the heart, but it can also harden the heart.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that is it all depends on the perspectives. It seems like the perspectives that we take as we enter into suffering and the people you interact with, it seems like maybe there's a whole complex web of interactions in your life that happen that help determine whether suffering softens your heart or hardens your heart.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting. I like that she said that.
Yeah. And you know, when you're in the midst of suffering, do you want people around you or do you want to be by yourself?
Yeah.
Both? Both? I know my wife Julie, when she's sick, she didn't want to hear from me. That's the last person she wants to talk to. But, you know, it's that character thing. Each person is different in their needs. I saw a microphone. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've got it before I did, but I was also going to add on that maybe it's also a factor of other people responding to your suffering as well that can maybe help direct you. It's going to be bitterness or softening that happens with your heart. Because, I mean, I had a friend who died of cancer in college, and she certainly went the bitterness route. And I felt like it was because we were young and we didn't know how to react properly and how to like enter into that suffering with her.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was just going to bring that I think that other people entering into the suffering with you is part of the equation.
I think the bitterness is fine.
Yeah.
the anger, the lament. God can handle that. And I think, you know, I think maybe some of the way I was raised is, don't make him mad. You know, don't shake your fist at him. But if you read the laments, man, God's getting some pretty good questions. Yes?
Well, I'm just thinking, one, you know, you started this by saying the mystic spent a lot of time in this, right? And so I think I think it all ties back to what you said at the beginning. And our lived experience, our worldview, our cultural view, our individual view. And I know in the work that I do, working with parents that are raising youth, navigating multiple systems and a lot of behavioral health situations, one of the biggest things that the parents talk about is the isolation and the shame due to their children's behavior, and that it isn't until they find community of other parents who have felt the same way versus other parents. And there's a difference between having shared lived experience. Mm-hmm. My story is not the same as your story, but my story touches your story. My story, I know what it's like to have shame and guilt around your parenting story, right? Mm-hmm. So I can sit with another parent who has shame and guilt around their parenting story. Mm-hmm. The mystics spent a lot of time looking at this. So they were able to come to a different place. I think I took a 4-week class, I'm good to go. Okay, now I have all the answers, right? And it's like, this was lives dedicated to deep, deep contemplation about it. And I think that's kind of the problem. We live in a microwave society and we want the answers. And okay, Bill, you went through this big thing, so in 4 weeks you're going to tell us all how to navigate it. And that's the problem of the Christian faith. We want it to be microwaved.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, good points. Yeah, and that's why, Karen over here, I want to say something. That's why I think these conversations are important. Death and suffering, we're all headed there. And if you experience it for the first time without having processed it at all, it's going to be really intrusive. Karen?
Well, you know, what we're describing is a process. You know, it's not an event. It is something that happens to you over time. And so you may experience many different ways of responding, which are uniquely yours. Mm-hmm. And it may have something in common with other people's suffering, but the way that you experience it may include a lot of different feelings and behaviors and attitudes.
Right. Yes, thank you. And that's why I think a lot of those support groups are so successful. You think about AA or you think about Al-Anon or whatever, you know, I mean, you're in a room with people that understand exactly what you're saying. And I think that's really helpful to have someone that's been on a shared journey and can speak into what you're feeling. And also not just speak into what you're feeling, but affirming it. Alpha.
I was, when we were at Campbell, there was a psychologist that was on staff.
And he was an ACA. And I didn't know what that meant at all. And it's an adult child of an alcoholic. And I didn't know there was such a thing. I was that thing. But I didn't know there was a category. You know, I knew the alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I'm the child, but that's completely different. And I didn't think about how it affected me. Mm-hmm. It didn't really, you know, I knew it did. I mean, that wasn't strange. But that there's actually, and there was a support group.
Right.
When I went to it, what was interesting is so many of them had, some of them had much worse than I had dealt with. Others were, like, they didn't even really know their dad or their mom drank a lot. They just knew they fell asleep every night after drinking beer, you know. So, I mean, it was this gamut. And I remember thinking, well, I don't really belong here because I didn't have it that bad. Mm-hmm. You know, even in here we are all kind of the same category. So, I mean, that really taught me that I'm, for one, unaware that brought suffering to me. I mean, I knew it did, but I didn't think It was something that I carried, I guess is a better idea.
Right.
And then also that even though others were in the room with, you know, an alcoholic dad, it was a different story.
Sure.
Very different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, behaviors that are learned can either be survival behaviors or differentiate, when you can differentiate yourself from what's going on, is, I think, an important move. But sometimes in the midst of suffering, and I've said this before, is you don't want to talk about it right there. You know, it's not until you're older in life where you can reflect back and understand. You have the cognitive experiences in your life that can help you connect the dots.
My sister and I are 8.5 years apart. We were raised in the same household.
Mm-hmm.
We have the same parents, so on and so forth. We perceive things very, very differently. And our theologies, well, she doesn't have them. So my sister is an atheist, or at the very least agnostic, but she's pretty much atheist. She's often hated God.
Can you pull the mic up?
I'm sorry, and she perceives everything that happens to her as like a punishment, or the world's out to get me, you know, and so on and so forth. And I had exactly the same parents, and I have tendencies to have the opposite view.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I didn't grow up. I grew up as a preacher's daughter. I was more of a preacher's daughter than she was,
right,
because of timelines. And so my theology from the pulpit was from my dad,
mm-hmm,
and it was not a black and white theology. There was a lot of gray in there.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he got fired a lot. But anyway, well, we call them moving servants.
There you go.
But I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just really interesting to me. So I don't think it can all be what you're raised with.
Right. True. Yeah. I mean, my sister and I ate at the same table.
Right.
Grew up with the same dad. My sister died of an overdose about 10 years ago. I don't know why. Why wasn't I the drug addict?
Right.
Why was she the drug addict? You know? And I just, yeah. So, yeah, family system, you can't hang your hat on just family system. I want to get going. One more comment. Does someone have a comment? I think this is really important. I mentioned Lewis sent me an article earlier in the week, and it's by Susan Nelson, Facing Evil and Evil's Many Faces. She's a professor of theology and culture at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, and it really helped me when I read the article. It helped me kind of categorize, if you would, just the idea of suffering, the ways of suffering. And Lewis, man, jump in anytime you want here. But the moral view is thought to be the most widespread understanding of the problem of evil. So this model or paradigm attributes evil to the sinfulness of humanity. I want to start pulling apart that relationship that we have done or put together, that, you know, evil and God. How can God do this? Right? And so basically, the moral view of suffering in the world is the sinfulness of humanity. The decisions that were made, you know, even in the garden, you know, once they made this choice to separate themselves and think for themselves and do for themselves and remove themselves from God, God let it happen. And that's when everything kind of goes a little sideways for humanity. Nelson also says radical suffering is another model. It explores the notion that there is not justification for evil in the world, and it is our response instead that matters. So, evil's in the world. Can't deny that. How do you respond to it is what this radical suffering is all about. How do you navigate it? How do you respond to it? How do you learn from it? How do you choose to live your life in the midst of it going forward? Her third category is ambiguous creation. The world is finite. In other words, it has an end to it. It's not everlasting. And we have limited control over the environment and our relationships. We are not in control. That's a tough one. Because we like control. We like to control everything in our lives. But just want you to know, you don't have control. Evil is the experience of our finitude, of our finite lives in a chaotic world. Big one here. Eschatological imagination. It's basically the now and the not yet. When we take these emblems, it's kind of the banquet that's coming, but not quite yet. So that's an eschatological tension that we live in. So this view points beyond our suffering and into narratives of resistance and liberation. This understanding of evil posits that evil will not have the last word. What is one of the scriptures you hear at funerals? O death, where is your sting? You know, it's kind of one of these, a death, right? You're not going to have the last word. Redemptive suffering. This paradigm understands the impact of suffering on people, but claims that some suffering can be used to reclaim sinners and reestablish a life-altering relationship with God. That's a mouthful. But basically, through suffering, a reestablishment and life-altering relationship with God can now be established. I would like to talk with Erin here pretty soon about how she thinks about God right now. What does he look like? What does he taste like? What does he smell like? What's he doing in her world? How is he in her world? It changes when you suffer. And so this redemptive suffering is a way of looking and maybe trying to understand a little bit and establishing a new relationship with God. Questions, comments? We've got about 10 minutes and I got one more slide. Lewis.
I think what I like mostly about this is she comes to the end and says, not any one of these is the correct response.
Right.
Nor are any of these an incorrect response.
Right.
And what I really appreciate about it is those are all in our canon. Mm. They're all in our tradition. Mm-hmm. And that it seems to me the wisdom of the tradition is to recognize the multiplicity of experience, mm-hmm. of understanding. And I think part of the challenge for us is we are always attempting to make sense of our experiences, mm-hmm. and the experiences of others in our world. I think that's where we run into and bump into what we consider inappropriate responses to suffering.
Right.
But what's driving us, at least in part, is attempting to make sense of the world. We come from a tradition that tries to do that.
Right.
And I think you honor, you know, you can pick any one of those in any moment and say, yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah, I think.
Or I can't.
Yeah, thank you. Good words. This is kind of a capturing of what's already in our Bible, our canon, our belief system. They're all right, they're all wrong kind of approach. I think the problem is, as human beings, is, I forgot the word, but we have the ability to think about our thinking.
Metacognition.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Beta.
Well, I guess I keep thinking about the, you know, the last week of Christ, and he's walking towards his greatest suffering. He's been in that role and showing us, you know, all this way. But, you know, even he says, you know, take this cup away from me. Mm. And then at the very end, he says, why have you forsaken me? Mm. So I mean, yeah, there's just, you know, the acceptance of where we are and what's about to happen, and yet we walk towards it, and I don't know what else to say about that, but it just strikes me that, you know, he felt what we felt.
Yes. That, it, man, thank you for sharing that, because doesn't that make him relatable now? His humanity, his fullness of humanity, is that he, even though you see in the scriptures, there's language that says he turned his face toward Jerusalem as he was headed toward Jerusalem. So a lot of the language in the synoptics has Jesus going and doing deliberate things, knowing that he's going toward evil. He's going toward his death, but yet he goes. Arthur.
So, yes, in that way, I've always been thinking about why Jesus has died on the cross for us, and how he's felt, what we felt, and we felt what he's felt all the time.
Yeah, it's almost like a reciprocal type of relationship. You know, yeah. Thank you. I want to finish this. This is important. So, next slide, please. I really like this idea. And this is right out of Susan's work here. It's called privatization theory. The key idea is evil is not a thing God created, but a lack or corruption of the good. God didn't create darkness. He created light to separate the two. So darkness is just the absence of light. So evil is just the absence of good. And God didn't create evil. Evil exists. That's big. That's big for me. Is why would God do something, put something before me, knowing that I'm going to do it? He's not creating evil for me to step into. Evil is the absence of good. Evil is what's going on in the world today. I mean, just good night. Just look around. Evil is everywhere. And so Augustine, and these are big hitters, Thomas Aquinas, you know, this was really in their world. God only creates what is good. Evil arises when creatures fall away from the fullness of good. God is not the author of evil. And I want to say amen. I want to say this is the best news that anybody can hear in our world today, is that this is not of God. This is the absence of good. And what is good is God. It's not God removing himself from the situation. God is right in the middle of it. He's not causing it. He's existing, and he's walking with people in the midst of it. We have about 4 minutes. Comments?
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yeah.
Is in this sort of conversation, are the words evil and suffering synonymous?
That's what I'm doing with it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm putting the two. Because I think suffering is evil in the world. It's me being a finite human being that has stage 4 lung cancer. God, figure that one out. Figure that one out. Yes?
So I absolutely 100% believe that. But also, you have to be careful, because that can lead right back into suffering being a direct result of your actions or inactions. Right? The evil being a result of not being in the fullness of God.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Again, all these ways that we describe, that we try to make sense of things, explains things and creates complications at the same time.
Yeah. So, yeah, good point. But I will say this, it's my choice to have 5 or 6 drinks and get behind the wheel and go kill someone. Right? suffering in my life and suffering in the world. It's my choice. So some of our choices that we do make are evil choices. We don't think about what's going to happen, but honestly, a family minding their own business getting killed in a car wreck, that's about as evil as I can think. All right. Next week, I'm going to try to summarize all this. I really enjoyed this journey, and I think it's an important conversation, just like the theology of death and the theology of suffering. It's in the world. We have such a strong community here that we can walk together in the midst of our own sufferings, and I appreciate that so much. This is AA. This is Al-Anon. This is everything that God has assembled for our journey together. So, thank you. We'll finish next week.